We're discussing federal grand jury indictments of a Wisconsin strip club owner and manager and what it means for this industry and the work to root out human sex trafficking. Please be aware, this is a sensitive conversation on The Morning Show. Please take care. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earlier this year, a federal grand jury charged Radomir Buzdum, formerly of Watertown, and Timothy Miller of Watertown for offenses in how they ran TNT Strip Club, which was located in Dodge County. And according to the indictment, they tried to drive up revenue by operating an unlawful prostitution business. Do you live near a strip club? What is law enforcement doing to ensure illegal activities are not taking place? It's 800-642-1234. Mary Spacuzza is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Mary, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me on, Kate.
Well, fill us in more on this case and the federal charges against these men.
Well, so this is just the latest string of charges against Wisconsin strip club owners and operators. We've seen quite a few in recent years. In this case, Radomir and his manager of both of TNT Strip Club in Lebanon were accused of essentially profiting, especially on their champagne rooms and VIP rooms. They did some renovations where they did things like installing locks, set up cameras in a way that wouldn't record what was going on in the room. Changes that federal prosecutors say were essentially to help them profit from sex trafficking at their club. They're accused also of working with sex traffickers, of what's commonly known as pimps, helping them either operate out of the strip clubs, allowing them to control women who were working in the strip clubs, who were also working for these men. Often these women said they were sex trafficking victims, that they were being abused and coerced and forced into prostitution by especially one pimp who was involved at TNT, who's also been, he's been charged and also convicted.
Yeah, you know, the status conference revealed that the case is based on information gained during the prosecution of Christopher Childs, who was found guilty of sex trafficking at this strip club. Has, like, one case led to the next?
I think in a lot of these cases they have, where one, you kind of, it's kind of like dominoes falling, where there's one case and then that leads to an investigation, or they find things in, and that leads to charges for other individuals. So Christopher Childs, the court documents really portrayed him as a sex trafficker who was frequently threatening, abusive, and violent towards women. Some really gruesome things in some of those court documents. I won't get into some of the details, but it really sounds like he was, according to the documents, quite brutal with some of the women working for him. He has been convicted, but in the case against him, there were quite a few things that were concerning about the strip clubs where he was operating, and that essentially that he kind of worked with strip club owners and operators to control women. They would report back on the dancers' behavior to Childs. Some of the allegations were that he was just allowed to essentially operate there, free drinks, treated like a VIP. I think some of the allegations were that, like, they carried bags for women who worked for him, things like that, where it was almost like he just had free reign of some of these clubs.
You know, the government has a lot of information here. The status conference had some numbers that was given to the lawyers. The government has about 30,000 pages of discovery data from 18 devices, 23,000 pages of materials produced by the IRS, 93 witnesses. What do you make of the volume of evidence in the Buzdum case?
So I think one interesting thing is that supposedly, from what I had read in the Childs case, that a woman came forward. She was identified as victim number one in the court documents because they didn't want to release her name. She talked about being coerced into and being trafficked by Childs. as part of that case, they started gathering things like Facebook messages, social media, phone calls, texts. And then that led to they found communications with others and they connect. So it's, I think a lot of these cases, they kind of connect the dots and one charge could lead to other investigations and other charges. And I think that's what we're seeing here. And so I think some of the volume of the documents that they have is related to they kind of pull one thread and see what comes loose in other cases.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Mary Spicuzza, who's an investigative reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's been long reporting on cases involving human sex trafficking. And this federal grand jury indictment, the latest here in, of a strip club owner and manager in Wisconsin. Mary, how is this case and others like it linked to the levels of sex trafficking happening in Wisconsin?
You know, I think sex trafficking is a really underreported crime for a number of reasons. Often these women are some of these women aren't even women, they're girls, they're minors, often very coerced, abused, and kind of recruited because they might be in a vulnerable situation already. And then often they might be too scared to report or think that this sex trafficker is actually looking out for them or, you know, that they're almost like family. And so we really, I think we only have really kind of know the tip of the iceberg of the extent of sex trafficking and human trafficking in Wisconsin and around the country. So it's hard to know exactly how much, like how many numbers we're talking about with victims because it's so underreported. But I do think it speaks, I think cases like this speak to the fact that this is not, Milwaukee is often talked about as a, heightened problems with sex trafficking, human trafficking. I think this case reveals, and we, as you know, a lot of prosecutors have talked about, it's not just Milwaukee, it's not just cities, it's a lot of rural areas and really stretches through, suburbs, rural areas throughout Wisconsin. And often these networks of traffickers will traffic women away from their homes. So it might be someone who's from Milwaukee, but who's then taken elsewhere to either other cities or rural areas to be trafficked.
And when you mentioned tip of the iceberg, I'm wondering this business model that Buzdom had in, being charged with operating an unlawful prostitution business, what might be going on at other strip clubs in the state?
That's a good question. I know there are strip club owners who say that they're trying to root out sex trafficking at their clubs and that they wouldn't have anything to do with that. I think that there are a lot of questions about what goes on in especially things like champagne rooms or VIP rooms. I think it's long been known and long been a problem that strip clubs have been linked to sex trafficking rings. So I think it would be helpful if some of the patrons who go to strip clubs, they may mistakenly think that sex trafficking is a victimless crime and that they're just having a fun boys' night or boys' night on the town. And I think it's important to realize that, if people didn't patronize sex traffickers, they would be out of business and demand helps fuel their profits. So I think especially for women who are or girls who are underage, who the term child prostitute is really, I think, a term that should be probably retired in favor of sex trafficking victim because minors cannot consent to have sex. I think that thinking of women that they're not all there just of their own free will, to be aware of things like that might help kind of change attitudes about sex trafficking victims
and, Mary,
and what might be some of these clubs.
And Mary, very quickly, what are you watching for in the federal charges in the Radmir Buzdom case and Timothy Miller?
I think we'll certainly be looking for what comes out of this case, if it leads to charges for other strip club owners. A lot of these clubs, this one was very much owned by by Radomir and operated, but a lot of other clubs are owned by LLCs rather than individuals. And this one was actually owned by an LLC, but largely controlled by him. But so you don't necessarily know who all the owners are of an LLC or who owns a strip club. And so I think we'll be trying to keep an eye on if this does lead to charges or investigations at other clubs and who are the people behind those LLCs. And, you know, what's in those documents in terms of how places operate, how these kind of places operate, and how they profit from sex trafficking.
Mary, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Mary Spacuzza is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Coming up, we talk with a Milwaukee-based advocate and survivor working to stop the cycle of human sex trafficking and to support victims. What efforts can you talk about in your community? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're looking at how to end human sex trafficking and provide support to victims. Please note this is a sensitive conversation. Please take care. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The number of human trafficking convictions each year has steadily gone up over time. That's from the 2020 Federal Human Trafficking Report out this month. It stated last year federal courts convicted the lowest number of defendants in human trafficking cases since 2012, and the vast majority of criminal cases involve female victims, women and girls. Do you know someone at risk of becoming a victim? What are the circumstances? How are you working on this issue in your community? Join in 800-642-1234. Nancy Yarborough Banks is founder and executive director of the Milwaukee-based Fresh Start Learning, Inc., advocating for victims of human trafficking. Nancy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nancy, there are these preconceived ideas you've heard so many times over that human trafficking only happens with people in poverty, only happens somewhere else, or it's a snatch and grab type scenario. Can you dissect these myths and explain the reality of human sex trafficking?
You know what? Absolutely. I mean, there is a common misconception when you don't know something, and where we say ignorance is bliss. And in this case, it really is, only because we know that the average age being 13, which we know is reported, but the average means there is some above and some below of young ladies and young men being pulled and lured into exploitation. That means wherever there's a child, there's vulnerability. Mm-hmm. So that means anywhere. I've worked with young ladies now upward of 10 years, and I've seen them from the suburbs, from the rural area, from Indian tribes, from Hmong community. It hasn't had one caveat like most people would think. A black girl issue in the inner city with a single mom must be on drugs. You know, that is not the scenario at all. It's the curiosity that lies in the heart of everyone and the vulnerabilities that lies in the heart of every child and the need to feel loved and accepted. Now, the next thing that I found out was more of the curiosity that pulls anybody in because I want to see, I want to know. You know, and the way that they're streaming now trafficking is more appealing to our youth than ever before.
How do you see traffickers using the internet as a tool to lure victims?
Well, you know, there's all kind of apps, even some of the apps that we might not think that are used for this particular pull in or draw in or grooming process. Something as simple as Christian Mingle, which we have Instagram, a Finstagram, which is a fake Instagram. There's so many different ways. Our children are more apt, or anyone that has a heart of vulnerability that may have been in a domestic situation or trying to make ends meet. Those kind of CEO kind of pimps, which means more business oriented, use the internet quite a bit because there's an opportunity for photo shoot, an opportunity for massage parlor, an opportunity for escort servicing, you know, an opportunity to show up as, an extra in a room for a video. You know, all these things are very appealing to our youth. And because the world in its streams of influence causes our youth to believe that it is okay between music and videos and things that we watch on primetime TV, it's almost impossible for our youth not to think things that are sexually and high in sexual content is okay.
I want to talk about your organization here, stepping in, providing a space for victims, and you call it Humble Beginnings Drop-In Spot. What do victims need when they come to you?
You know what? Because I was a young lady and that my vulnerabilities pulled me away into the life of exploitation, I just thought about all the things that I may have wanted to make it feel more like an adjustment from that life to the next life. So when they first come in, we offer brand new pajamas, fuzzy socks, a hot shower, something to eat, you know, just so that you know once you walk into those doors, everything else behind you is now closed. There's no pressure. There's no pushing, no prodding. I realize that when people are open and feel safe and comfortable, they'll have more of a fluid conversation. So for us, it's making sure that we're meeting them where they are using harm reduction and then matching them with a program for a longer term support and care is essential. It's not just getting them a place to stay. It's what is the biggest barrier? Is it mental health issues because of the trauma? Is it drug addiction first? Is it legal issues to get your children back? There's all kind of layers, but we let them be a part of it. And that's the most important thing.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Nancy Yarborough Banks, who founded Fresh Start Learning, Inc. Her nonprofit gives a voice and support to people who fall prey to sex trafficking. Nancy, what are your conversations like with people you are helping? Is there a way you can describe with sensitivity what they have experienced?
Absolutely. Again, coming from a personal standpoint and then coming from a professional standpoint, I love the fact that God has allowed me to have both conversations when it was me and now when I'm on the outside. So I'm very sensitive to being a big ear, right? I'm just want to listen first, you know, and then interject when I'm asked. The main thing that I've learned, if somebody is talking about their trauma, what they've been through, there's no time for you to say, oh, well, he was no good for you. She was no good for you. She meant you no well, even though our heart knows that. It's up to us to understand they have not allowed themselves to detach from that love interest that they thought that was there for them, that took them in when nobody else wouldn't. All the manipulation and the mind games that are played in exploitation. We have to remember, if that person trusts you enough to start talking, the best thing you can do is listen. And when they ask you, then start answering to the best of your ability using your I statements. And remember that you're talking about human nature. So as soon as you start trying to tear down a wall that you didn't help build, it's going to be really, really reluctant to have that person trust you any further because they've already been used to the games.
One of the things that you do is help connect victims to legal support, legal services. And, you know, we've been looking at these cases and about sex trafficking in the courts. And I'm wondering what strikes you about these strip club cases and whether there is any action.
I think that sometimes it's the hardest thing to come against something that's already established. If a person believes this is a legal entity, it has the doors and the ability to have the doors open and people patronize the place. When you start talking against something that people say, well, they had a choice. They could have said no, they didn't have to do it. They could have told someone, you know, all those things come into play. And for that, a lot of the victims are scared to speak up, you know, to say that I was violated in the way that I shouldn't have been violated. I ask myself a lot of times, once you find the younger girls inside of these strip clubs like I was, why didn't you card me? Fake IDs are very real, but you can look and tell this child is just a child, you know, and I think that once our police system and the legal systems come together as an opportunity to say, let me look back on this child's history to see if there's been petty theft for lingerie and all those kind of things. I think when they do the restore and rescue, they'll have more of an opportunity to build a case against those strip clubs and other places that take advantage of the vulnerable.
When you talk about restore and rescue, how could law enforcement do this work differently and not put blame on the victims?
Education. I've had the pleasure of doing a lot of awareness and prevention campaigns through our legal systems, and even our hotel chains. Everybody that has a part in this needs to have education based on their role in this particular person's life once they become in contact with them. The training cannot be cookie cutter because it's not going to be the same way. The officer's job is to protect and serve, and he's given or she's given a manual on how to handle different situations. But in that manual, do they have dealing with a vulnerable youth that may be very aggressive because they've already been told the police is not your friend, don't trust them, don't believe them, they're against us, to let them know it's not about that. Look at that person and realize the first thing, what are they doing here?
So much to discuss. Nancy, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Nancy Yarbrough Banks, Executive Director of Fresh Start Learning, Inc. You can find help at the National Human Trafficking Hotline, 888-373-7888. News is next on the Ideas Network.